Accession number 30632, Mrs. John Langford, reel 3.
If they came.
So anti-tank ditches?
Yes.
So how they'd be pretty big. How do you do that?
With a pickaxe.
So hard labour.
That was hard labour, yes.
Anything else they had you on doing?
Yes. Building latrines. And that became interesting. I passed my cross, and from that day on to the end of the war, I was paid for tradesman second class. Honestly, that's true.
So there's an actual trade of latrine building?
Yes, oh yes. I was paid tradesman pay, I think it was 2 shillings a day or something. And also...
So how would you build a latrine? What did you have to learn?
Boards and 4x2s and... Some you had to hold up as you were having a... It was all jocular, you know. We didn't take it too seriously because we had no experience.
Anything else with 220 Pioneer? Because you go to 251 Pioneer Company sometime.
Yeah, that was Cheltenham. There wasn't 251, it was Cheltenham.
You said that was 220.
220 and 251. Well, they almost amalgamated because... One was made a German company, one was made an Austrian company. I don't know which was which. I think 220 was retained as a German refugees company, and 251 was Austrian.
So you wouldn't particularly notice when you went from one to the other. No. That's fair enough. That's very, very... Anything else you remember about... So it's taken all quite a long time, this, you know, the...
Well, we covered quite a few years, haven't we?
You were there on various duties for several years.
Yes,
and so what's the next thing that happened? You seem to be in the south of England after you're more now with 251 Pioneer Company.
Mm-hmm.
And leading up, were you aware of any preparations for D-Day? Were you involved in it at all?
Well, we were involved when we built our latrines on in Southampton on Southampton Common. That's where the Canadians were assembled prior to D-Day.
So your role was to build the latrine. I mean, someone has to do it.
Oh, yes, someone had to be done.
And, I presume there's a lot of latrines that you had to build.
I can't give you the numbers, but it subsidised my small income for army pay by 2 shillings a day. I think it was 2 and 6 as a sergeant.
Now, at this point, it says in your memoir here, this is a very short memoir, we're going to put a copy in there, in either your file or the Department of Documents. Lieutenant Geoffrey Perry intervened.
Yes, yes.
Now, we've interviewed Geoffrey Perry, a very long interview. Mm. Now, how did you come in contact with Geoffrey Perry?
Geoffrey Perry arrived, as far as I was concerned, as a second lieutenant in whilst we were stationed in Southampton, I think.
And what were your first impressions of him? Because we know him...
Baby face. He still has a baby face today. And we remained close friends ever since.
You liked him then?
Yes. And he had a charming wife, unfortunately, died.
I mean then. What was he like as an officer?
Well, liked him. It wasn't a question, you know, people who were suddenly promoted to an officer rank, they often didn't want to speak to the others.
But he did.
Yes, Geoffrey was all right, yes. Well, he came from our lot, and he was very good.
Now, he suggested something to you, didn't he? He suggested you should get out of the Pioneer. Tell us about that. What did he suggest?
Well, he said there were interviews to various branches of the British Army conducted by Mr. Buckmaster, number one, and then... Open book was thrown open to any of us, and I chose Airborne Division.
Now, what do you remember about your interview with? Is it Morris Buckmaster? I think it's.
He was in Dorset House, Baker Street, wasn't he?
Do you remember the interview with him?
Yes, it was brief. He told us, warned us what we would be facing, and I was too young and too uneducated to. Do their jobs to be quite frank.
This is SOE, is it? He was recruiting for. What was he recruiting?
Commandos. Commandos and special forces.
And you were rejected, were you?
No, I withdrew.
Why did you withdraw?
I didn't think I was fit enough for it. There were, for example, you might remember Walter Room. He joined the BBC after the war. Did you know him? He was fitted out as an SS Standartführer or something, and walked across the marketplace in Hanover, and the young man came over and said, "Walter, I thought you emigrated to England." And within 2 hours, he was back home. That's the type of jobs. And there was another man called Becker, who was the untidiest soldier we ever had. Whenever he came to any parade, we sent him to the village to buy sweeties. And yet he became one of the most outstanding soldiers. When you looked at him, you're like Schweik, the soldier. You know, we were ashamed to be in the same outfit. But he was a brave man. So you can't... I say there are no heroes. A hero is the man with the back to the wall. And there's only one way to go is forward. That makes you a hero. You don't plan to be a hero.
Now, you opted out of this. You felt it was too much for
right.
you. So you made a realistic appraisal
right.
and you thought, I can't
and
do it.
I
so what did you do instead?
I went and volunteered for Airborne. Where was that?
You seem to be in training at Salisbury.
Where?
Salisbury.
Well, that was the HQ headquarters, 6th Airborne Division. I was first sent to Moor Park Golf Course.
Where's that?
In Hertfordshire, here. And interviewed by a major Greek name, I think he was Greek, to see whether I was fit mentally and physically for airborne duties, and he passed me.
Do you remember the interview, what it was like?
Yes, tall, Greek-looking guy.
And what sort of thing was he asking you? How was he judging you, do you think?
Mentally stable, I suppose, was number one. Aware of what could happen.
So what next?
And I was that time where I was stationed in a house in London Road, Stanmore, which was owned by Attlee, the forthcoming Prime Minister.
Now, what were you doing there in Stanmore?
Well, we were billeted there because I was sent to Moor Park Golf Course, which I visited recently, hasn't changed much, to the 1st Allied Airborne Corps, and we were picked according to ability. I was a German speaker, and my colleagues were mainly all teachers whose second language was German. And that led on to the next part of my army life.
So, now this isn't in it, none of this is in here. So, this says you went to Salisbury. So, this is all happening before?
Salisbury, Bulford, Salisbury, yes.
This all happens before that, then?
I think so.
And so what are you doing in this?
Oh, training.
What kind
of training?
We were
also prepared for military government. Military government was always planned to take over.
Now, I'm not quite sure what's happening. So what unit do you join? You join the field security?
317 para field security.
317?
Para field security.
And you joined them right from the start?
Well, you know, the start was before D-Day. I wasn't with them then. I was still...
No, I mean from the start of when you joined them, that was what you were in.
Yes.
You weren't in any other units before that within the airborne.
No.
And that's part of... And 317 Parafield Security is part of 6th Airborne, is
that's
it?
That's right.
Now, where were they when you joined them?
In Belgium, ready to go into Germany. I think.
Now, I know you're confused about this because the time's got to
expire,
but
yeah.
It doesn't matter, does it? I mean, so you joined them in Belgium?
Yes.
And what was the situation there?
I was in the Pioneer Corps still when we were landed at Caen to clear up the city of Caen, which took a hell of a... It was all shut down, there was nothing standing. And we arrived 2 weeks after this happened, and the smells were unbelievable. But we had a job to do.
And what were you actually doing in Khan?
Collecting the killed soldiers, clearing up the streets.
So that doesn't sound like a job. That's a job for field security, is it?
No, that was a job of the Pioneer Corps.
But you were in the...
After that. From there, I was promoted to field security. That's clear.
Right. I can't make any sense of which units you're in. So you're in either the Pioneer Corps or 317 Parafield.
Well, there was a transfer period from Pioneer Corps into Airborne. And Airborne is a division which had, I don't know how many men we were at the time, but it had the need for foreign languages. And that's where we came in. And as soon as our forward troops made prisoners, we were called in to interrogate the German prisoners.
And what do you remember of that role?
Well, what's the right word for that? It gave me a certain satisfaction.
But in what way?
Well, we felt superior to the German army.
So what were you interviewing them for?
The strength of their companies, what their plans were. Frontline interrogation was called.
And what kind of techniques were you using?
Well, talking to them as much as we can to get the truth out, because some wouldn't even speak to us. There was one young German soldier in a camp, and he was being interviewed, and he said, "I'd rather kill myself and give you any information." And the sergeant major, whoever it was, pulled his gun and shot him. But today this wouldn't be allowed, but in those days it happened. I would say once a man gets into uniform, he's a different character.
And are there any stories you particularly remember other of interviewing people?
Well, that came later when I was in Berlin. Interviewed civilians who came from the East. Well, come on.
So you did an interview interpreter's course as well in Brussels. Do you remember that?
I interviewed what?
You did an interpreter's course in Brussels. Do you remember that?
Yes.
What about that?
It wasn't in Brussels, somewhere outside Brussels.
What do you remember of that?
Not a lot.
Just that it happened.
Exactly, yes.
So what's the next thing you do remember? You're basically going through Normandy, and then you go through into Germany. Just pick the things you remember.
I don't know where to start. Going into Germany, we were...
Before Germany, there's Brussels. You were in the first vehicle to enter Brussels. Tell me that story.
That was Sunday afternoon. Our division liberated, we call the liberated Brussels. And I was in, I think it was the first vehicle, and the women were throwing chocolates and everything at us. We were the heroes. And I was then stationed, yes, that comes now. And my course at Interpreters Corps was at the Tour et Taxi in Brussels. That's where I was billeted. Right in the heart of Brussels was the customs building on platform number one.
And that's where you did your interpreter's course. What about after that then? What do you remember after that?
After that, I went forward and forward with the troops.
And just interviewing any German prisoners?
Or whatever work that was to be done with the Germans.
What else might you be doing?
Well, any main information that they could give us about their positions, their strength, their plans.
So that's interviewing again, so.
Yes, that went straight back to our HQ, whatever they did.
Any incidents you remember, from moving into Germany? You seem to have been with 15th Scottish then.
15th Scottish. They were our relieving division, yes. I think they came, I'm not so sure, I think they came from Italy, 21 Corps, 15th. All we knew, when we heard the Scottish troops were coming, we were scared that they would drink us under the table. And all I knew is after a few days we drank them, and they were very loudmouthed Scots, but not so good at fighting.
So what happened as you moved into Germany?
No, Germany came in late. In between then and Germany, we crossed the Rhine. And I got as far as Wismar.
What do you remember about crossing the Rhine then?
Well, we were visited, I think it was through Churchill, and the King came to see us. I know it was Churchill, I don't know whether the King. Did he come to the Rhine? And we were crossing in the Bailey Bridge, which the engineers threw across, and got to Wismar, which was a lovely little town, and I was stopped by a German young couple, and they said, spoke very good English, they said, can you help us? We are Jewish, we have survived the war, what can you do for us now? I don't know what we did for them.
So what next then? You start to fight through Germany, don't you? You have to then get through Germany. What do you remember of that?
We got to Germany as far as Hanover. And Major or Brigadier Hill and I were sent over as the first British troops to plan the Potsdam Conference area. And we crossed the line at Wunstorf, I think it was called, Wunstorf am Meer, where we started our campaign into Germany, and I was then told, no, there's something missing. There was a Dakota standing by for me in Brussels, because I stayed out the night. And when
now, that's much later, that is. That's right. So what about the end of the war then?
Well, the end of the war, we were meant to go on the victory parade in the UK. The whole division bar, Staff Sergeant Langford, that was me. I was ordered to stay behind as the official interpreter for the relieving division, which came up from the south.
Were you upset about that?
I was very upset, and I went to this Colonel Eden, and he said, well, I've got orders to leave you behind, but he says, we've known each other long enough. If I find you in my Lancaster, 30,000 feet up, I'm not going to throw you out. And with that, I ran and sat in the cockpit of his Lancaster plane, passed out half a dozen times because it was so hot. This plane was standing by. And we were landing, we then landed in Salisbury. And instead of victory parade, we were given SEAC leave. And that I didn't like at all. 28 days SEAC leave meant SEAC Southeastern Command. And then orders came through that
now this is where you have to go to the headquarters, 1st Allied Airborne Corps at Moor Park.
There's a Moor
this
is where this, back part, in England.
This is part of that confusion that we had earlier. So you were then sent on a secret mission and prepared for military government training. That's all happens then, just after the war was finished. So what is this first secret mission?
What missions?
This secret mission when you have to go to Brussels after military government
training. Well, that was preparing for the military government for the Potsdam Conference, I suppose.
So tell me about that.
Well, the 6th Airborne Division was sent to Palestine at the time. And because of the Haganah expected to fight the British troops, Britain wouldn't send Jewish personnel over. And there were four of us. We were taken out of our units on the 6th Airborne Division. and sent on secret missions, and mine was to become bodyguard to Churchill at Potsdam.
Now, what do you remember about the preparations for that, and what, you know?
Well, we weren't so much involved in preparations. We had the engineers to do all that. We were there for security, to make sure that it was bomb-proof and everybody behaved himself.
And so that was... tell me everything you remember about that, because there's not many people left alive who were at Potsdam Conference, is there? Yeah. What do you remember about the whole thing?
Well, Potsdam was where these troops were stationed to supply security for the British delegation. We were very low in numbers with passes. Unfortunately, I haven't got my wild pass anymore. I think a Russian got hold of that. I don't really know it. Yes, we were supplied from a villa where Churchill stayed that belonged to Professor Urbik. I've got photographs somewhere of that. And Mary Churchill, very recently, went to Potsdam, hoping to see where her father operated from, but the owner of that building wouldn't let her into the house. That was published in the papers. I read that.
Now, what did you think of Churchill? And then
Churchill was a leader. Now, the greatest thing that I shall ever remember is during this 4 weeks at Potsdam, elections took place in England, and Labour government came in, and Churchill came out. And we knew when Churchill was up. Churchill worked in his bedroom till about 1:30. But when he was up, you knew he was up. He didn't have to tell you he was up. There were two fast doors intercommunicating the entrance hall to the ballroom or something. I don't know what it was. And we knew exactly, we could hear him. And then one day, a little man came through, and my Scotland Yard colleague was a man called Sergeant Green, who I think became Prince Charles' bodyguard for many years after the war. He died recently. And Green and I looked at each other, and we were puzzled because nobody ever would dare come through these doors other than the Prime Minister. And we came to the rash conclusion that must be the new Prime Minister of England, of Britain. And he said, "Don't bother, boys, you'll be seeing more of me now." That was Attlee. So the first meeting between Churchill, Attlee, and Stalin was when Stalin said, "If Mr. Churchill had been here, this would not have happened. The prestige of the British government dropped to below freezing point." But he was a great man, but unknown to anybody. Who knew Attlee? With Bevin, who always smoked, he smoked 60 to 80 cigarettes a day, always had a cigarette in his mouth. And I was on guard outside the conference room, and a man came in who didn't know who he was. A man came in, spat his cigarette on very expensive Turkish carpets and trod it in with his foot. And that was our Mr. Bevin. Eden wouldn't do that. So, and the young man that's made a big impression, but still stays in my mind now.
Do you remember anything about your actual guard duties?
Well, we were there. We knew he was there, and we had to be there for 4 hours, I think, at the time.
And what were you doing on guard? Just standing there?
Standing there, making sure nobody breaks into his apartment. I was partnered by Sergeant Green of Scotland Yard, and there was a Sergeant Shaw, was number two, Henry Leighton, number three, and a man called Norton, number four. Harold Shaw, I don't know what happened to him. Leighton married his girlfriend in Berlin and lived there ever since. Yes, how I shocked this reporter whose article you've read. He thought that was an impossibility. A German refugee guarding Prime Minister.
It seems
you run back to Glasgow and printed that in the papers.
There's a little report, which is in this this book that you're donating to the museum, which will be in our, probably in the file, I think. And so this reporter was... Well, did you actually do an interview?
There are incidences, yes. But then they are more women-related, I think. Because I made a statement to you earlier, I said, but given ordinary, decent man a uniform, he behaves quite differently. And that is exactly what happened then. We used the Café Brüssel in Berlin for drinks and what have you. And as we were leaving, one night I said to the sergeant major, we will take the underground because we're both drinking. And there was a girl there, and he became a bit abusive, and I apologized to her and said, let me buy you a drink tomorrow night. And I turned up the following evening. I didn't recognize her. Here on the first night, she was dressed in fisher's uniform. She went fishing at the lake. And here she was wore a mink coat. And she became my official companion because she is of Danish origin. We were not meant to speak to German nationals. But as she was Danish, I was allowed to speak to her.
And so she was your girlfriend for a while. Now, any other stories from your time with Potsdam?
It was a great experience. I mean, there were only, there were four of us, but there were probably 20 altogether. And one of them was a Home Office hiccup to do that. They were meant to do us the honour.
Well, did you have any impressions of Stalin or Truman, you know, the other leaders? Or did you see them at all?
Oh, yes.
What did you think of them?
Well, Stalin was Stalin. Not too many words were spoken. Truman, who we probably remembered as one of the better presidents, he was a non-entity at that time. Nobody knew him. But he was quite a good man, wasn't it?
And that's what you thought of him at the time?
Yes. Well, they were unimportant to us. We were there for church and nobody else mattered.
Now, one thing, I forgot to, you changed your name. I should have mentioned this. Although you're John Langford now, that's what you changed it from, because you originally...
Whilst we were in Bicester, stationed in Bicester, we haven't Bicester in yet.
Well, we missed that, but... No.
The War Office issued notifications that those who are planned to go abroad, it would be sensible for them to change their names in case we got caught and we would be treated as traitors, not as prisoners of war.
So you changed your name from Erwin Lehmann to John Langford?
Lehmann to Langford. Why? Because I was at the railway station in Bicester and I went into the telephone cubicle and looked up the Oxford phone directory, and the first name with my initials was something E. Langford, and I said, Langford Lehmann will do. And he was very sarcastic, the sergeant major. Next day on parade, when we read out, he said, don't come back calling yourself McCowan or McSolomon. And by the time the War Office gave us this, we'd forgotten what names we applied for. This can happen, you know.
Well, it didn't mean
but
a lot.
It was for our own security in case we got captured.
And so your name was Lehmann. It wasn't John Langford. It was
Edwin John Michael. Because I had nobody to go to and say, what would you advise me? I had no parents or relatives here, so it was all my own doing.
So you changed it to Edwin John Langford.
Edwin John, yes, it came because of relatives.
But you dropped the Edwin.
No, I've never used it as a name, but the official papers always quoted E.J. Langford because they had no room for three and four Christian names. So it didn't bother me, but in business I was known, I had a worldwide business and I was known as John Langford.
Now, So the